Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Paul Wagner here, host of WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place. If you like what you hear, we hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple. That helps us get discovered by other people interested in true crime podcasts. Now, to this week's episode. Previously on WTOP's American Nightmare series, Murder in a Safe Place.
What we were doing was we were serving grand jury subpoenas on a lot of people.
The police position was that this is completely voluntary. People want to cooperate to find a murderer. And we knew differently from speaking to the union members.
They did a story with Chief Farrell on the front page of the USA Today. I mean, if you didn't know about it before that story came out, you sure heard about it afterwards.
So it made national news.
Sure.
I'm sure everyone was nervous, especially the women.
As January of 1998 slipped into February, and February into March, the public's interest in the curious murder of Sherry Crandall slowly began to fade. With no suspects and no arrests, the story fell off the front pages of the local D.C. newspapers and was no longer the lead story on the evening news. But in the Crandall family and inside the homicide section of the Prince George's County Police Department, there was no slowing down. The three Crandall kids and their dad were intent on getting some answers from the hospital, while Detective Bernie Nelson was still trying to find the killer with the DNA and fingerprints recovered from the crime scene. When his mom was murdered, Darren Crandall had already mapped out a career in law enforcement. He's now a sergeant in a police department outside Washington, D.C. He asked that we not identify the agency. What stunned all three siblings was the fact their mother was supposed to be working in a safe place. How could this have happened? As the days turned to weeks and the weeks to months with no one charged with the crime, Sherry's children were beyond frustrated.
Had someone get into a hospital and get into an area that's, you know, semi-controlled, semi-secure, that has on-site security, and, you know, murder somebody and then just vanish. You know, how's that happen? And then how does the police department come to us and say, you know, no fingerprints that we can identify? No one dropped their wallet, you know. There's no picture of someone running from the scene. No one saw this person or whatever. There's nothing, you know, like. The investigation starts with that, and you think, okay, well, it's going to progress. It's going to progress into now we have a suspect, or now we have this, or, you know, information is going to come forward. So try to be patient with it up front, but then the patience turns to frustration. You know, it turns to eventually anger, and then it turns to the blame game. Like, who didn't do their job in this, or are the police doing their job, or are they doing a good enough job? You know, is the hospital cooperating enough? Are there people that have the information that are withholding it for some reason? You know, you just start thinking of all these different possibilities, and it makes you even more frustrated, more angry.
Remember that email Sherry sent to hospital administrators that I told you about in episode 2? The one where Sherry raised alarms about security and recent thefts inside the family health center? When the Crandalls were made aware of it, two of the siblings say they were completely surprised and horrified. But Darren told me his mother was worried enough about her own safety and the safety of the staff that she brought it up in one of their conversations.
She wasn't happy with security there at all. She felt like the security personnel didn't do much of anything there. She felt like when they called for security to come, for whatever reason, to her area of the hospital, to her family practice center, the response was not expedited in any way.
Luke Crandall, just 16 at the time, says his mother never discussed her security concerns with him, but he certainly knew her devotion to her job and the staff she supervised.
If she brought work home like that, I didn't see it. She considered that place like a second home. You know, if somebody's trying to steal something out of there, it would be like them trying to steal from her.
All three of Sherry's children told me they were frequent visitors to the hospital and their mom's office in the family health center, so they knew firsthand what kind of security measures were in place. Tiffany says it wasn't much.
Where my mom worked was the family practice center. It was down a very long hallway, sort of separate in a way from the hospital, but attached, and you could access it through the parking garage. So you'd come off the parking garage, walk down the hall. There were some double doors. You go through the doors, and you're right there. You could walk around that hospital freely. There were no check-in points. You have to give a badge. You have to give your ID.
No key card system?
Not that I recall. So... who knows who could have just wandered in from the parking garage.
And you never had a conversation with your mother where she said she felt unsafe there?
I never did, probably just by the nature of me being, you know, gone at school and then coming home, and I had a trip and then, you know, back off to Penn State for a few days. It was really a blur from when I graduated to when she died. It was such a short period of time.
Darren says he was able to walk around the hospital freely as well.
Growing up over the years when she worked there, I'd go in there sometimes on my days off from school and hang out with her at the office. I'd even sometimes dress up like in a lab coat and walk around like I was a doctor, you know. And sometimes the patients would even ask us, is there on the Doogie Howser time? So is he a doctor? How old is that? I'm like, no, it's not a doctor, you know.
The lead detective in the case, Bernie Nelson, says the investigation was initially handicapped because he couldn't get a handle on who was coming and going from the hospital's main building.
As far as visitors go at the hospital, that was hit and miss because they didn't have security. They didn't have a front desk. They did have security, but they didn't have it set up the way that you find in hospitals today, where everyone has to sign in and get a badge and present identification.
The night the TV was stolen from the family health center, it had taken security as long as 40 minutes to respond to a call for help. Sherry was rightfully angry and clearly scared. I want to go on record and voice my fear that the next incident may involve a personal assault. This was too close, she wrote in her email to administrators. That email was sent on December 23, 1997, 21 days before the murder. It was addressed to Dr. Clark Holmes, the director of the Family Health Center, now deceased, and Clinton Cole, the director of security at the hospital. Two of the hospital's vice presidents were also CC'd on it. It was because of that email and the security issues the police investigation would uncover that the Crandalls would eventually file a lawsuit in June of 1999 against Broadway Services, the company that provided security for the hospital. Most of what we know about the hospital's security, or lack thereof, comes directly from that lawsuit, along with media reports at the time and subsequent interviews I've done with police for this podcast. Clinton Cole, the hospital's director of security, who worked directly for Broadway Services, was fired 3 weeks after the murder. We were unable to reach Cole for this podcast, but at the time of his firing, he spoke with the Washington Post and told the newspaper he thought he was being unfairly held responsible for the murder. A spokesperson for Broadway Services told the Post in a story published February 4, 1998, that Cole's dismissal was unrelated to Sherry Crandall's death. But Cole told the paper, quote, "Naturally, I don't think it was fair, but I have no choice but to accept it. I don't know if I'm being made a scapegoat or not, but it's part of the job. You're in charge of security. Something happens, and you have to take the blame." In further comments to the Post, Cole defended security at the hospital, saying it had improved since he arrived in 1994. Quoting now, Cole said, "I don't think the officers who worked there were lax or didn't do their jobs. I think it was one of those things that could have happened anywhere, unfortunately." The lawsuit filed by the family in June of 1999 makes a number of claims about security at the hospital, including these allegations. Quoting now, the lawsuit says, "There was no restricted access to the fourth floor by stairs or elevator after 5 p.m., even though business in the family health center had usually ended by then. It says most hospital entrances were watched only by receptionists and that Broadway security guards patrolled in zones instead of in fixed locations. The lawsuit says, on the night of Sherry's murder, only three guards were on duty and expected to cover the 40-acre campus. It goes on to say about 30 surveillance cameras were positioned inside and outside the hospital buildings, but they were not monitored in the same location. More importantly, most were either decoys or broken at the time of Sherry's murder. The lawsuit also alleges there were no cameras on the fourth floor, a claim you may remember was disputed by Detective Nelson, who said there was a camera on the fourth floor, but there was no tape in the recorder. The lawsuit also mentions another shocking crime that happened at the hospital 11 years before Sherry's murder. On June 11, 1987, a woman walked into the pediatrics ward and took three-week-old Jeremiah Tate out of his crib and walked right back out. Despite a massive search and saturation publicity at the time, the newborn wasn't found until 4 months later, when police, following up on a tip, found the child in the care of the woman who had kidnapped him. In addition to the child abduction, the lawsuit also claimed a hospital resident had been raped in the early 90s, and that there'd been a carjacking at the facility's loading dock.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Detective Nelson says he learned a lot about security at the hospital as he methodically went about his job, trying to find the man who killed Sherry Crandall.
There were around five or six other complaints about thefts.
In the family practice center?
Yes, in the family practice center.
And these were petty crimes, like going in and stealing a dollar here or a dollar there? Or
not necessarily thefts, but some of them were suspicious people hanging around the family health center.
Mm.
Sometimes you probably don't even realize something is missing until well after the fact, and they probably didn't put two and two together, but there were a number of complaints about suspicious activity.
The lawsuit mentions these thefts as well. It states, quote, "In the weeks prior to her murder, Mrs. Crandall made other numerous complaints to Broadway and Dimensions regarding the lack of security in the area where her office was located. Some of these complaints were made after a computer was stolen from her office, and similar crimes were reported by hospital staff in nearby offices. Mrs. Crandall never received a meaningful response to her complaints regarding security from Broadway or Dimensions," end quote. Dimensions refers to Dimensions Health Corporation. Prince George's Hospital Center was a division of Dimensions, and it was Dimensions that contracted with Broadway Services for security. Throughout the course of this investigation, Detective Nelson came to his own conclusion on the level of security at the hospital prior to Sherry's murder.
Based on how security is in hospitals today, I would say yes, it was very inadequate. From what I understand, they only had one security officer who was patrolling the floors on the night of the incident. Naturally, that changed quite a bit. Now they have a front desk that you have to check in if you want to go beyond the desk to visit anyone. So it was woefully inadequate at the time, based on especially now that what you see in hospitals.
The lawsuit also says, quote, over the last several years, the hospital's nurses union and other staff, including Mrs. Crandall, expressed grave concerns to Broadway Security and Dimensions Healthcare about the high incidence of crime at the hospital and in the surrounding areas. They also complained about an insufficient number of security guards to monitor the hospital's building and parking lots. It complained that hospital doors were left propped open and that parking lots were dark and not patrolled. The lawsuit said it was easy for any stranger to wander through the hospital without being looked at twice. Tiffany, who now goes by her married name, Tiffany Lane, says there was a noticeable improvement in security after her mother's death.
You and your brothers and your dad decided to sue the security company, and I know you have a non-disclosure, so you can't really talk about it. But ultimately, your objective there was to improve the security at the hospital, and you believe that that's what happened. Is that right?
Well, I do know that later, after months had gone by, after my mom's death, when we would go back to the hospital, there were changes. You couldn't get in from the fourth floor anymore, from the parking garage. You had to go into the front, and you had to present your ID, and you got a visitor badge. And there was no more roaming the halls. You had to be escorted. And they put in panic buttons, and they put in peepholes, and you have to hope that in some ways it did make the hospital a better place, and that she didn't die in vain, that other people might have been saved of some other harm that could happen to them.
Online court records show the lawsuit was filed on June 28, 1999, and came to a close in October of 2000. Homicide Commander Mike McQuillan spent several days at the hospital after the murder and got an inside look at how security had been configured before Sherry's murder.
What was your sense of the level of security at the hospital there at that time?
It was obviously a concern that was brought to our attention. But see, Paul, the thing about a homicide investigation is it's the only crime that you don't get to talk to the victim, and we can't get tunnel vision. We could sit and what if it any day, date, time, and place that we tried, but that's what the war room was for, to guide you down the path so that you don't go running off in the wrong direction or different directions. Take the lead you have and go with them. And that's the way these homicide investigators, Bernie included, step by step. And that's what we reinforce daily. Don't get out of kilter. Go, we've got a woman dead in the hospital. Let's find who killed her.
In the weeks and months after the murder, with still so many questions left unanswered, Mike McQuillan says his investigators set up a war room inside police headquarters.
That room was probably a little bit less than this size, but I mean, you've got posters on the wall with to-do lists.
So we're in a conference room, possibly 10 by 20. And so it was a room about this size?
It's about half this size.
About half the size.
It's an interview room.
So about 10 by 10. And so
you've got whiteboards up on the walls with calendars and to-do lists and black magic markers and red magic markers and green magic markers, all color-coded as to what we were going to do, what needed to be done, what information we had developed, information given out at various, you know, meetings that we all got together. And that was pretty much a daily routine, if not twice daily, to critique a case so that the people coming to work in the evening on the next day or the day after were all up to date on what had been developed during the previous shift or previous day.
So you had a lot of moving parts there.
Hundreds.
And were you in charge at that point, or did you put somebody else in charge?
I was the commander of the unit. I mean, I'm the command. I guess you could put it all on my back. But the sergeants, that's one of the successes I had, is I just let people go do their job. All I asked them to do is come to work and give me 8 or 12 or 16 hours a day, and every one of them did it. No questions asked. They'd go to war for you. And that's why we call it the war room. Those guys and girls would go to war for you.
As the investigation moved along, there were no successes, only setbacks. And one of those setbacks briefly threw the investigation off track. Detective Bernie Nelson.
We had a number of walls. And we had a lot of stuff that we had to deal with in reference to someone sending letters to the family.
You had to rule that person out.
Well, we had to investigate that because he was leaving messages with sexual connotations and letters that he was sending the family. I think they received six of them, which started less than 2 months after the murder and lasted for a couple of weeks. On one of the envelopes, he even said that he did it. And we were, I can't go into how we were able to narrow it down as to who it was, but we did find that subject. And it turned out to be an elderly male living in the same neighborhood who turned out to be an acquaintance of the Crandall family. And when we approached that subject in his front yard, we noticed in his car sitting on a dashboard, on top of the dashboard was another letter addressed to the Crandall family. That was very upsetting. It took us away from what we really needed to do in the investigation, but we had to run that down. But it was very upsetting that this person, who obviously had some mental illness, would prey on the victim's children, because that's who received the letters.
Right.
And we just couldn't understand why. And he didn't have a good explanation as to why, but he said he'll stop doing what he was doing. We didn't charge him. But he was warned that if it keeps up, we will have to take some legal action.
The case stayed hot for several months after Sherry's murder, and at times it was an all-hands-on-deck situation for Prince George's County investigators. As we've been telling you, police went through name after name after name, trying to rule people out through their DNA. The detectives went so far as to track down homeless people at shelters who had at times been known to sleep on hospital grounds. As the years went by and the $26,000 reward sat unclaimed, Detective Nelson says they never received any anonymous tips. It was like they were chasing a ghost. In the weeks after the murder, as investigators were hoping to close in on a suspect, life for Sherry's youngest child, Luke, had been turned upside down.
Some of the good times and the worst times of my life happened during that time. I ended up after my mom was murdered and the dust began to settle, I had started drinking, ran into having a drinking issue and went to a rehab facility, which was probably the best thing I ever did, and was there for a week or two or so and saw other people and heard their stories and realized that, you know, there is a way to climb out of this. You know, it's not, this can't be me. You know, this is not going to work. My mom's not going to, I can't live like that. You know, she wouldn't want to see it like that. So I went through the rehab facility and at the time I was living with a buddy of mine, and his parents. After my mom was murdered, you know, our family had a rippling effect of just waves of just, as you can imagine, I mean, it was just grief and anger and who did it and where are they? Why haven't they been caught? I mean, what, you know, who does that and walks away from it?
In those dark days after the murder, Luke says he was lifted off of a perilous path he was taking by one of his mother's close friends. Susan Caffrey and her husband Jim took Luke in and helped him get his life back on track.
My dad began to see someone else. You know, he wanted to move on, you know, with his life, and gave us an option. you know, we could live with him or, I guess, you know, do your thing. And we, I didn't want to live with him. He was not there for my brother and sister and I. And I think that, you know, part of that was negative in our healing. You know, you're trying to grieve, you know, as a family. You have to grieve as a family. You can't grieve by yourself. I mean, you can, but that murder happened to all of us. It wasn't just one of us. And so we had, I just don't think that it was very beneficial the way that that he went about things afterwards. So in my head, I had nowhere to go. I've known them forever. And they also had the same beliefs that my mother did. And what was actually discussed before my mom had been murdered years before was there was my buddy's mother and another mother in the community that said if anything ever happened that they would take in their kids. And so it was that and the fact that I kind of just leached to her. She's very good at realizing when somebody's in pain. And she knew how to straighten me out. And so I owe everything to them. If it wasn't for them, you know, I'd maybe be on in the coroner's office. I could have been buried. I wouldn't have a family for myself at this point, I'm sure. So they are great people, no doubt about it.
When I interviewed Tiffany, Sherry's oldest child, she told me about the second guessing that's gone through her mind over the years, especially with the case unsolved.
Because what happened to us when we were so young, you know, there's definitely a thing that happens in your brain and you just sort of stall at that point in your life, you know, especially when I think about my 16-year-old brother, it just shuts down for a while and you can't really get past that age. You're just stuck. And it, you know, I have a lot of guilt over not becoming more involved, not becoming more of a crusader. And, you know, I had a family member tell me the other day, you know, to just really be kind to myself, you know, just that I was a kid in a sense. You know, I was just starting my very first job from college and taking care of two brothers. We ended up living, me and my two brothers, in the house for a while. And you still can't help but feel like you know, is there something I didn't do personally? Is there something I should have done? But hang up more flyers, you know, even though I think we did do that. But, you know, what was missed?
Tiffany's brother Darren has wondered that as well. About 10 years after his mother was murdered, Darren Crandall says he approached Detective Nelson about taking a close look at the case himself. After all, he's a cop. He was wondering, with his law enforcement experience, could he possibly notice something that may have been missed?
I don't know what the catalyst was, but I remember reaching out to Bernie. I said, hey, would you mind if we met and I could maybe see the case file? Can we go over the case file together? Can you show me the case file? Can I take a look at what's going on? And I had to kind of tread very cautiously with that because I didn't want him to feel like, you know, I'm going to review your work. No one likes that. No one likes it when someone says, I'm here to help. I'm going to go over what you did before.
Right.
But I just said, you know, would you mind if we met and we went over this stuff, maybe more detailed than you have in the past? And I think at that time, I had started a career in law enforcement, and I think I was less than probably 10 years of police experience, but a reasonable amount, you know, not certainly not my first day on the street, but and he he obliged, and we met, and he let me ask questions and look at stuff and review things and kind of take notes on things I thought I had questions about. And I remember visiting his office with him many times, probably over the course of a month or two or 2 months, probably a dozen or so times. And each day, you know, we review and look over a different portion of documents or, you know, whatever. I never had any access to any real evidence or anything like that, but I was able to discuss a lot of things at length and look at some reports and things like that. So for me, I don't know if it was a little bit self-serving, like maybe I can figure it out type of thing. You know, maybe mm-hmm. I can go and figure it out.
But we hear that all the time about a new set of eyes, a second yeah. set of eyes, right? Were you looking at it that way?
I mean, I think it'd be disingenuous to say that I wasn't. It wouldn't be truthful to say that, I wanted to, not for me to find it, but to find it, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like I wanted to go through it and say, oh, you know what, this right here, this kind of didn't get looked at. Maybe we can look at this a little closer.
Mm.
And then maybe that would take somebody in the right direction. And maybe my relationship with my mother and knowing the people at the hospital and being there so many times, maybe there's something that I know that I don't even know is important. Maybe there's something mm-hmm. I'm going to see or read and say, you know what, I remember this, and let me connect it to this. Okay, now we have something. So it definitely was that feeling that I had. I felt like I wanted to make sure I didn't have something to add that wasn't already out there.
Right.
You know?
After 18 years of nothing, Prince George's County Police were dealt another setback. In 2016, the FBI told Detective Nelson the Bureau was removing the genetic footprint of Sherry's killer from CODIS, the National DNA Data Bank.
It was about 4 years ago that we actually received a letter in the mail indicating that the DNA from her case was removed from CODIS because it no longer met the standards to keep it in that database.
Was that a surprise?
I knew that they were changing the standards. They were improving them. And that there were some other cases that were kicked out. So it wasn't a total surprise. It was just upsetting that it was, because I knew now that we had nothing going on in reference to DNA after it was kicked out of the database.
What happened is highly technical, but for the purposes of this podcast, let me explain it this way. Until December 31st, 2016, the FBI allowed DNA samples into CODIS with at least 13 loci, or what are referred to as locations of genes. But as of January 1st of 2017, the FBI required a minimum of 20. So the genetic footprint of Sherry's killer was removed because it didn't meet that threshold. Meaning this, if somehow Sherry's killer committed another crime somewhere else, and his DNA was entered into the CODIS databank, there would be no chance for a match or what investigators call a cold hit. It was a terrible blow. The only chance Detective Nelson now had for a match was that fingerprint taken from the cord in Sherry's office that was still in the law enforcement databases and regularly checked against other prints. The murder of Sherry Crandall has weighed heavily on the mind of Detective Nelson over the years. Listen to what he told me in 2014 and the way he directly addresses the killer in an interview I did with him for one of my TV reports on this case.
This is a case that's been bothering me for 16 years because I want to bring some closure to the family. And for 16 years, I haven't been able to answer the question as to who committed this crime. And also, most importantly, as to why. Why did you feel that you had to kill Miss Crandall? You know, even if it was the fact that you were trying to steal something out of her office or even commit a sexual assault, why did you have to kill her? Why did you have to take her life?
In my first interview with Detective Nelson for this podcast in July of 2020, He admitted that he's felt pressure to solve the case.
Definitely felt a lot of pressure. Not only pressure from the family, pressure from the media, pressure from the higher-ups on our department. It was a red ball case, a high-profile case. I put a lot of pressure on myself. That's where most of the pressure comes from. This is one case, and all of my cases I would love to close and bring closure to the victims' families. But this is definitely one case that bothers me continuously. As a matter of fact, I have a reward poster for Sherry Crandall's murder posted at my desk. It's been there for the last 22 years.
So every time you sit down, you see it in front of you?
Every time.
In other police departments, this case may have already been taken away from Detective Nelson and given to another investigator for what police like to call a second set of eyes. It happens, especially with cold cases, but Bernie Nelson will not let this one go. He says he can't. He owns it. So, in the spring of 2020, Detective Nelson went back to the FBI to see if the Bureau could do anything more with the DNA it had kicked out of CODIS. Some of the most difficult murder cases in recent years have been solved using genealogy, a process in which detectives tap into databases like GEDmatch and FamilyTree USA. You may not know this, but people upload their DNA to those types of websites in order to trace their heritage. When police tap into these databases, the hope is that they will find a genetic lead to the person they are looking for. Maybe a cousin or a brother that would have similar DNA. Detective Nelson wanted to know if that could work in Sherry's case as well. Since they had no success matching the DNA in CODIS, why not try this new technology that didn't exist 23 years ago? Tracking a killer by tracing his relatives, using those ancestry databases. Detective Nelson was all in. He had nothing left to lose. Coming up in Episode 5, a case as troubling as Sherry Crandall's and with striking similarities is finally closed when police connect a Virginia Beach man with the murder of a shopkeeper in Maryland using genealogy. Could their methods be the key to solving Sherry's murder as well?
He just told me that, I'm sorry that I have to tell you like this, but we did locate the man who we believe murdered your father, and he was shot and killed this morning, and it's going to be on the news, and so we wanted to notify the family.
What did you think at that point?
I thought I was going to pass out.
Murder in a Safe Place, Season 2 of WTOP's American Nightmare series, has been written and produced by me, Paul Wagner, and CaseJackets.com. Like what you're hearing so far? Please take a moment to subscribe and leave a review on Apple. That helps us get discovered by other people interested in true crime podcasts. We have more on the Sherry Crandall case, including photos of the family, the videotaped interview with witness Edna Brown, and behind-the-scenes footage with me on our website, AmericanNightmarePodcast.com. Reporting and production of this podcast was supported by a grant from Spotlight DC, Capital City Fund for Investigative Journalism. For grants, please apply to spotlightdc.org. Have a question you'd like to see answered in a future show? Email me at paul@wtop.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @AMNightmarePod and on Facebook at facebook.com/AMNightmarePod. If you know anything about the murder of Sherry Crandall, you're asked to call Crime Solvers at 866-411-TIPS. That's 866-411-TIPS. This podcast series would not be possible without the help of Sherry's three children, Stephen Friedman, the Prince George's County Police, Shirley Montague, Detective Bernie Nelson, and Mike McQuillan. Editorial assistance from Julia Ziegler and Craig Schwab. Music for this episode is Runway 47 by Immersive Music and Flum Flum by Up North Music. Subscribe today on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And thanks for listening.